The Bible reading this morning comes from Romans chapter 13, and you can find it on page 1123 of the Black Bibles. Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and he will commend you. For he is God's servant to do you good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword for nothing. He is God's servant, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also because of conscience. This is also why you pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. Give everyone what you owe him. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honour, then honour. Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another, for he who loves his fellow man has fulfilled the law. The commandments: do not commit adultery, do not murder, do not steal, do not covet, and whatever other commandment there may be, are summed up in this one rule: love your neighbour as yourself. Love does no harm to its neighbour. Therefore, love is the fulfilment of the law. And do this understanding the present time. The hour has come for you to wake up from your slumber, because your salvation is nearer now than when we first believed. The night is nearly over. The day is almost here. So let us put aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armour of light. Let us behave decently as in the daytime, not in orgies and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and debauchery, not in dissension and jealousy. Rather, clothe yourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ, and do not think about how to gratify the desires of the sinful nature.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Eric. I'm one of the ministers here, and I'm currently questioning whether I should get up there and preach. Okay, here we go. If we can get a sustained applause for me to go up there. Well, here's the deal. How about I crack all my jokes from up there and do all the serious stuff from down here? I will get up there, though, don't worry. I will get up there. Keith said he'll give me $100 if I did it. Every day we make decisions. We all make decisions every day. Should I get up there? Should we smack our children? Should we send our kids to Christian schools? Should we turn off the life support? Should we turn back asylum seekers who come by boat? Or from this week again, does everyone have the right to be a bigot? We all make decisions every single day. For in the moment of decision, our awareness of ethics is most acute. Ethics describes and analyses our thoughts about what's right and what's wrong. It not only helps us develop a framework to decide moral dilemmas like, what should I do? But most importantly, proper ethics helps us live rightly. In Romans 12, verse 1, we saw last week, therefore I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer our bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Now, worship is about living a life that's holy and pleasing to God, living rightly under and before our God. In Romans, Paul has devoted his time from Romans 12 right through the end of Romans on this issue, because we Christians are concerned with ethics. But when it comes to ethics, where do we start? How do we determine right and wrong? Many of us are probably thinking, well, we immediately think of commands and rules in the Bible, and maybe we sprinkle some values over them from all over the Bible. Now, they're all part of Christian ethics, but do we just pick and choose whatever we want? Or is there a coherent system in the Bible? I want to say up front that Christian ethics is massive. And my main aim today is to explain Romans 13, which we're going to be getting to. But in doing so, I'm going to introduce to you a very simplified model of Christian ethics. And you can find this model. I've got a picture. It's written by a guy, or put together by a guy from college, when I was at college. His name is Andrew Cameron. His head, his brain is the size of a planet. And he's that type of thinker that can think through how do we coherently bring together ethics so that Christians can actually read the Bible and make sense of it. And it's articulated in that book, Joined Up Life, which I recommend to you. So this morning, we're going to do something very simple. I'm going to explain this Christian ethics model. It's already a very simplified one. And then we'll look at Romans 13. So here's the picture. You've already seen it there. The picture is this. It's got four categories, all centering around Jesus. The first category is Jesus himself in the center, because all of Christian ethics is centered around him. Our ethics spring from him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So in the center of all of our Christian ethics, our goal is to follow this Jesus, who presents nothing less than a new way to be human. He reshapes, he renovates, he perfects all humanity. Maybe you'll fix the speaker system too. And with Jesus as a centre, there are four other categories around him. Let's keep them in mind. The first, at the very top, is God's character. Jesus says in Matthew 5:48, "Be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect." Just as Jesus himself is perfectly representing the Father and where to imitate God's character. His holiness, his faithfulness, righteousness, mercy, compassion, love. In Christian ethics, we can look to God as he reveals himself in Christ in the Bible to determine what is good. The next thing we see is creation on the right-hand side. Our good God created everything in the world with order and purpose. So Christian ethics needs to take this into consideration. What's good should be in line with its created nature and purpose. So for example, when we think about loving community, it's good because in Genesis, God created man and woman to be in loving community. So it means that being alone or isolated is not good. The next category down the bottom is rules and commands. The Bible is known for these rules and commands, and Christians are often known for them. They're important for our ethics, but suffice to say, even though Jesus did not come to abolish the law, we know that he fulfills the whole law. And the last category is the new future. In Christian ethics, we don't just look back at creation. We also look forward to what's coming in heaven. Where we're heading helps us decide and determine what is good. So ethics is complex. That picture seems pretty complex. Well, it is because life is complicated. So let me give a really brief example of how this model works practically before we get into Romans 13. Let's look at marriage, something very simple, hey? When you think about marriage, in the category of God's character, marriage is good because it reflects the Trinity. God is three persons in one Godhead in perfect loving relationship. So in marriage, we reflect this unity and loving relationship. When we think about commands, when we think about creation, sorry, marriage is between a man and a woman, and that is what God intended its purpose to be in creation order, a loving community with procreation with its purpose. When we think about commands down the bottom, Ephesians 5, for example, says the husband is to love his wife as his own body, and the wife is to submit to the husband. But Jesus, when you think about Jesus himself, he brings a whole new dimension to marriage. Jesus has become our bridegroom, and he gave his life to his bride, the church. So when we look at how to relate to one another in marriage, we'll look to Christ, who gave himself in self-sacrificial love. But not only that, we have a new future. Those who are single are not left out of marriage, because collectively we as a church are the bride of Christ heading to our wedding to be with him. We will all stand before him blameless. So whether you're single or married, you will be married to Christ. Our union with Christ is the perfect marriage we all look forward to. That's a very, very simple explanation and a simple example of how a Christian ethic might work. And I hope that gives you a very simple idea, a brief idea how this model might work. It can be very simplistic and overly simplistic, but we need to keep in mind those four categories and how Jesus unites them all. So with that in mind, let's get into Romans 13. Remember that Paul is up to the ethics end of his letter. His goal here is to exhort Christians to live lives that are holy and pleasing to God. Our passage here conveniently divides into three parts. The first part is from verses 1 to 7, and it's about living rightly under civil authorities. In verse 1, it says this: "Everyone must submit themselves to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established." The authorities that exist have been established by God. Paul's instruction here is fairly clear. If we go back to our model, when we think about the commands, we see here Paul is giving a very simple command. That is to submit. But he also gives us the rationale behind it. He points us to the order that God has established, that is, in creation. Civil authorities are divinely appointed, so much so that in verse 4, they are God's servants and his agents. God has placed them in authority for the good of all people in order to punish wrongdoers. Now, God's instituted order is the reason why submitting to civil authority is the right thing to do. Moreover, in verse 2, God's instituted order is the reason why rebelling against it is wrong and will bring judgment, which is reinforced in verse 5. Paul says, therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not because of possible punishment, but also because of conscience. So we Christians ought not just submit and obey because of the law, but because of conscience. God has ordained the state as God's governing servant. So we as Christians obey the rules of our land and we pay our taxes, which he says in verse 6. And then in verse 7, we also owe those who serve in authority, we owe them respect and honour. I'm going up there now. Here we go. I live close enough to St. Paul's to throw a rock at it, which I haven't thrown rocks at it recently. But as I was driving to church this last week, I passed not one, but two police speed traps in the 2 kilometre trip to church, one up Tuckwell Road and the other down the big U bend going up to Old Castle Hill Road. When I see police speed traps, I often think of two things. The first, as I'm driving by, I'm thinking, the police budget's a bit thin this week, eh? Or I think the second thing, as I'm slamming on the brakes, I hope I don't get caught. As I read this passage this week, as I was reflecting on it, it rebuked me, because I don't obey the law and our authorities not because I don't want to get caught or because I'm an unwilling participant, but I should obey the laws and the authorities and the police and our government because that's the right thing to do. Now, that is a really hard thing for us Australians to hear. Especially from up here, we Australians find it very hard to hear you must obey your authorities, because when I look around at the crowd up here, it's clear that many of you are descended from convicts. Now, let's talk about the sticky situation of taxes. As you can see, I am of Chinese descent, and so I have a genetic ability and genetic advantage of being able to handle money well. But when I was reading this passage this week, I was rebuked. I pay my taxes, and I should pay my taxes, not because I don't want to get caught or because I'm an unwilling participant, but rather out of good conscience. That is what we ought to do in respecting our God-instituted authorities. Does that make sense? Can someone get me down now? Don't worry, I'm not scared of heights. I'm just scared of falling and dying. Here we go. So God has instituted our governments. God has instituted our authorities. And we as Christians, we submit out of good conscience. So what's taught here by Paul is very insightful. We can apply it to a whole lot of other areas in our lives too, because in many areas of our lives, there are derivative authorities over us. We need to do the right thing. We ought to submit, not because we don't want to get caught, not because we're unwilling participants, because it's actually the right thing to do. Now, a number of you are probably thinking right now, well, that's well and good if the authorities did their job properly. That's well and good if the authorities weren't incompetent or malicious or didn't misuse their authority. Some commentators here suggest that Paul was just naive, that he'd only had positive experience with authorities. So that's why he wrote these things. I doubt that, and some of the gentlemen in the front, I doubt that too. Considering that he's been thrown in jail a number of times, he'd been persecuted by the Jewish authorities, and not to mention that he follows Jesus, who was put to death by the authorities. We need to realise that Paul is teaching us this principle based on creation order. But we also need to look at the bigger picture. The bigger picture of Christian ethics helps us determine what is right. So for example, let's think of an example. Say, for example, the government bans evangelism. The government bans every one of us Christians from going and talk to anyone else about Jesus. Well, let's think about that. What would we do? Should we submit to the government at that point? The short answer, I'd say, is no. Let me explain from this picture. We know that God has instituted the government through his creation mandate there. He ordains them. But we also know from God's character that to imitate God's love is to share his love by means of his salvation through the preaching of the gospel. And on top of that, God's kingdom consists of all people who declare Jesus as Lord. And then if you're thinking about a command, even though there's a command to submit to authorities, we're also called as Christians to preach the gospel. So that's one very simple application of that kind of ethic. Yeah, there's one thing there that says one thing, but when you add them all together, it gives us a whole picture of our Christian ethic, of how we can act. So having said that, I think that in general, Paul's instruction here applies because it is based on God's instituted order. So while I'm here, I might have a shameless plug for next week. We have that, as you saw before, we have the former Deputy PM, John Anderson, coming next Sunday. All of us sit on the one side of the fence of being under the authority of the government. We all sit there. That's where we all are at. But I want to encourage you to come next week and bring your friends and ask your questions, because we're going to hear from a man who was a Christian, who is a Christian, and was in the highest offices in our land. He sat in cabinet for 5 years. He was Prime Minister, our acting Prime Minister, during the two most significant events of the last 20 years in Australia. First of all, during 9/11, when they actually thought that John Howard was dead, he was Prime Minister. And then 3 days later, when ANZAC collapsed, he was Prime Minister. So come along next week, and you have an opportunity to ask John Anson what it's like and how you can develop your character, your ethic, so that you can be serving at the highest office of the land or wherever God puts you. Enough of that plug. So on to the second part. In Romans 13, verse 8 to 10, encourages us to live rightly by the command to love. Last week, John Gray spoke from chapter 12 on the practicality of love, of how to love. Chapter 13 circles back again to the concept of love. Paul's words here are exactly what Jesus taught in Matthew 22. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul and strength, and love your neighbour as yourself. The law was given by God so that his people may know how to live in holiness to please him. The intent of the law is to guide us in love, since it reveals God's character, his instituted order, and his future plans for us. And Jesus himself is the perfect fulfillment of the law. And so when Paul says love is the fulfillment of the law, well, that says we live by God's commands, not as a means to salvation, but to be like Jesus. And I find this very helpful, particularly verse 8. Paul exhorts Christians to love because that's what we owe to everyone. In our individualistic world, in our I world, where our rights and entitlements reign supreme, shifting our thinking to think that we owe everyone love, now that is revolutionary. If someone says something hurtful to us, we have every single right to cut them off. We have every single right to hold a grudge. We have every single right to hurt them back commensurately. But if we love, that will change everything. If your friend disappoints you, what would it be like if you owed the debt of love and love alone? If your child breaks your heart, what would it be like if you owed only the debt of love? If your colleague reneges on the promise of support at work or something like that, what would it look like if you owed only the debt of love? The Bible-informed ethic says you owe not hatred, not revenge, not grudge, not jealousies, but you owe the debt of love. And that is revolutionary. And we shouldn't be surprised, because these come straight out of Jesus' mouth himself. If someone strikes you on the cheek, turn the other. If someone sues you for your tunic, give him your cloak. If someone makes you walk 1 mile, go with him 2. Now, if we owe only the debt of love, it may well be costly. It may seem inefficient. It may be inefficient. It may seem weak. But to owe nothing but love is the right way to live for God, for that is how we will be like Jesus. Now, finally, the third part is verse 11 to 14. And Paul encourages us to live rightly in light of the day that is coming. So we're thinking about the new future. The way Christians live is governed by what is coming. Look at verse 11. And do this, understanding the present time. The hour has come for you to wake up from your slumber, because our salvation is nearer now than when we first believed. The night is nearly over. The day is almost here. So let us put aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. In God's scheme of time, it's now dawn. We need to get ready. Just pause for a moment and picture the best looking model or actor you can think of in your mind. Got it? Now imagine having to go with this person to a red carpet ball. Now obviously we would prefer to be seen at our slimmest and best next to them. Most of us would go on a diet. Most of us would hit the gym. Most of us would buy new clothes, have a haircut, brush our teeth, all that kind of stuff. For at a profound level, something similar is at work in these verses. The dawn has arrived and the day is here, and we realize with a jolt how good it would be, if found in Jesus' company, to at least seem a little bit like him. So put on the armor of light. And when you look at verse 13, when you look at that list of things like orgies and drunkenness, sexual immorality, dissension and jealousy, we know they're wrong, but we're a little bit hazy about why they're wrong. But we begin to sense that next to Jesus Christ's way of being a human and next to Jesus Christ himself, they look bad and smell even worse. Verse 13 says, "Let's behave decently, for the way of being human sits better alongside Jesus. That includes things like compassion and kindness and humility and gentleness and patience and forgiveness and peace and love, which binds them all together in perfect unity." So rather than behaving indecently alongside Christ, Paul says, 14, clothe yourselves with Jesus Christ and do not think about how you might gratify the desires of the sinful nature. The command here is to be like Jesus Christ, and the command is to intentionally steer away from feeding our sinful natures. That means if you have a weakness for gambling, don't go to the RSL club. That means if you have a weakness for alcohol, don't meet your friends in a pub. For me, I stopped watching SBS a couple of years ago because we all know SBS stands for sex, booze and soccer. If you are scheming and dreaming your renovation all day and all night, if you're thinking about how can I make my barn bigger and better, then can I encourage you, stop watching Grand Designs. if you have a weakness for wanting to get rich quick, stop reading those investment magazines. Stop reading about those guys who make $100,000 in 3 months. Don't give your sinful nature food. The reality is that even though we can talk about things that are helpful and ways that rules we can make up to help us steer around, the reality is that we can only do this by God's grace and his strength. We can make every single plan in the whole wide world. We can come up with a manual this thick about how to steer ourselves away from every sticky situation. But rules alone will never change your heart or transform you to live rightly like Jesus. Rules will never do that. Legalism is not the answer. We're saved by grace, and we live our whole lives by that same grace. All our lives, all our ethics can only be by grace and by God's power. So live rightly, friends. Live rightly under civil authority by the command to love in light of our coming day.